choice but to leave. I slept through New Year's Eve and most of New Year's Day, feeling listless and despondent. And then, on January 2nd, I awoke with a new resolve. We were leaving. With a fire I hadn't known in years, I sprang out of bed and ran out of my bedroom for the first time in days. I barged into Naeem's room and announced, "Start packing. We're moving." He looked at me in confusion and then with a sense of relief. "I'm tired of everyone going about their lives and we're just stuck here watching them come and go. Everyone is having fun and living life and it's like we're living in a prison. So let's start by making a pile of things we're not taking with us and throwing those things out. I'll grab the empty boxes from the garage." Naeem didn't hesitate. The move was a long time coming. Leaving the house, the mausoleum, the shrine I created and kept up all in the name of pulling a family together out of a million broken pieces was more than a change of venue. It was an escape from Aaron. I started looking for apartments on the other side of town, out of the hilly suburbs and in the bustling city about 30 minutes away. I didn't want to live in that neighborhood anymore. I didn't want to see the same streets, restaurants, and stores Aaron and I visited over the past 5 years. It seemed as if every building within a 10-mile radius had a memory attached to it, and I wanted no part of any of them. In a flurry, I packed up the house and made arrangements for my furniture broker to buy back the majority of the furniture that filled its 3 stories. In the end, he bought over $30,000 worth of furniture for just $3,000, money I desperately needed. Even then, I still had to borrow money from friends to pay for the costs of moving and closing out my bills and the lease at my current home. I even got Aaron to shell out a few $100 and pack a few boxes the few times he came to visit. Whenever he inquired as to where Naeem and I would be moving, I always told him I wasn't sure and that I was still waiting to be approved for a place. It was never my intention to let him know where we'd be or to let him back into our lives once we moved. I was looking forward to a new start. Scared, but looking forward. The most difficult part about leaving the old neighborhood had to be pulling Naeem out of school and away from his friends. Even though he loved our home, he was ready to move on from what it represented and the energy that lived there. What he wasn't ready to do was change his life completely and move into the city for the first time in his nearly 13 years. Sure, we could have easily stayed in the suburbs. God knows it would have been a lot easier and cheaper. But I couldn't bear the thought of wallowing in the same town for one more day. I really just wanted to be happy. I really just wanted to be free. So, with our bravest faces painted on, Naeem and I walked through his school, getting all his teachers to sign him out of their classes, returning his textbooks, and turning in the last of his assignments. All of his friends, many of whom he'd known since kindergarten, wished him good luck and told him goodbye. He was so strong, and I knew he was doing it for me. But the moment we got back in the car and shut the doors, my son broke down and sobbed. Tears flooded from my eyes as my son grieved the life he was leaving behind and questioned the life ahead. I held on to him and tried my best to assure him that we would be okay, that the move would be tough, but that it was necessary for us to start completely over. "I'm sorry, Naeem," I said as I held my son, kissing his face. "I know this isn't easy, but we have to do it. We have to move on with our lives and try something new. This place is killing me, and that's hurting you. Just think of it as a new adventure, a new life for us. Just you and me, I promise. I'll make everything okay." As I dried his tears, I hoped my son believed me. I hoped he trusted me. And more than anything, I hoped everything I told him was true. I didn't know what was going to happen next. I didn't yet know where we would end up and if anything I was doing would be the right thing. All I knew was that I fucked up our lives, and I wanted to fix them. I searched for the right apartment in just the right neighborhood, with the appropriate rent and a feasible move-in cost. I called around and visited a few properties until finding the perfect one, and by January 14th, Naeem and I were moved out of the prison we inhabited and settled into our new apartment, all without telling Aaron where we were headed. By that time, after years of carrying such a heavy financial burden, my credit was shot, and between the closing bills at the house, the move-in costs at the new place, the price of the movers, and the storage we needed to keep things that didn't fit into the tiny 1,200-square-foot apartment, I was all out of money. Still, Naeem and I were headed to our new home and a new chance at life. I was finally going to start over and make right all the bad decisions I'd made since 2007. I was exhausted during the last night of the move and happy to be just 3 blocks from my new place with the last set of boxes piled into my Mercedes. Behind me, one of the movers was driving my SUV, also packed with boxes, while the other two trailed behind in the moving van. Naeem and I were almost home. Driving on a busy city street, lined with restaurants and nightclubs, we whizzed past one of many valet stands when suddenly a parking attendant opened a car door wide, hitting the passenger side rearview mirror of my car, snapping it. This was the last thing I needed. I'd recently made arrangements to return both my cars to the dealers, unable to afford the $3,000 monthly in payments. I was trying to simplify my life, and downsizing was the first step. But now, with the mirror broken, there was no way I could return the car and incur the outrageous dealership fee for having their technicians fix the damages. It would cost me less to have the mirror fixed myself, but I couldn't even afford cheap labor at that point. I tried for the next couple of weeks to raise the money to no avail, and I was just weeks away from having to return the car to the dealership. I needed help, and every time I felt vulnerable, I always reached for Aaron. I tried so hard not to do it this time. I tried so hard to depend on someone else, but after shutting myself away from the world for so long, there was no one I could call. Desperate, I called Aaron. It was a bad decision, and I knew that as I was making it. Moving was my first real attempt at leaving Aaron and my life without him behind, and I fucked it all up. I was so different from that girl who drove herself to the emergency room that I didn't know who I was anymore. He was all I knew at that point, and as much as I wanted a life without him, I didn't know how to go about getting it. Aaron was happy to come to my rescue. I sent him directions to my new apartment via email, and anxious to know where I'd moved, he came right over. A few days and $600 later, the mirror was fixed, and even though he was the one who paid for the repairs, I was the one paying the heftiest price. It was February 2nd, 2011, and Aaron was back in my life. Chapter 16, Order of Protection. It didn't take long for Aaron and me to fall back into our destructive routine. Naturally, not having had sufficient time apart, nothing changed after I moved out of the house. We were both still playing a game of cat and mouse, pretending we were leaving one another, saying we were done, but pulling each other back into the pit that had become so comfortable to us over the years. He picked up right where he left off, making promises he had no intention of keeping and disregarding my feelings, and I continued my efforts to somehow fix our relationship. Though our marriage was over, and I had grown to be okay with that, I still hoped we could be cordial and loving toward one another and stop tearing our children apart. The two boys had grown close during their years together and continued to refer to one another as brothers. But Aaron just couldn't help himself. He continued to be abusive and dismissive as I continued to accept it. But things were changing all around us and inside of me. Jonah's mother had been on a campaign to regain custody of him since about a year after foolishly signing what she believed to be a temporary custody agreement. With the help of her parents, she opened a child custody case in a Chicago court and began the fight to get Jonah back. By now, she was married and living in a home her father purchased for the newlyweds, Jonah, and her new husband's children from a previous relationship. She wanted her family to be together, and I couldn't blame her. I understood how necessary it was to have a family and to have that family be complete. Jonah's mother and her parents stopped at nothing to bring him back home to Chicago. They delved into Aaron's past and were having him surveilled as he went about his days in Los Angeles. They interviewed people who knew Aaron and had been around during the past few years as he reared Jonah, including me. During my conversations with Jonah's family in Chicago, I found out things about Aaron I never knew, and for the first time in 5 years, I refused to protect him. I told them everything I'd seen, things that would horrify any mother. Aaron was never the ideal father, though no one could ever tell him he wasn't doing it properly. He was oddly obsessed with Michael Jackson and had it in his head that Jonah's mother was just a carrier from whom he was justified in purchasing his child the way he assumed Michael Jackson had done with his children. He carried his son with him everywhere he went, treating Jonah more like an accessory than a person. This poor baby was being dragged to early morning and late night meetings and was walking around dangerous television and film sets, sleeping in trailers and in green rooms. Though I always begged Aaron to leave Jonah at home with me so that Jonah could get proper nutrition, rest, and care, Aaron mostly refused. The times when he did feel it was appropriate to leave the child with someone else, he would drop Jonah off at Mona's for days or weeks at a time, or at his sister's, brother's, or various friends' homes. All the while, Jonah craved stability and a sense of normalcy, just like I did. Aaron didn't really live anywhere when he wasn't living with me. He didn't have his own place and slept at this house and that with family and friends. For a time, before they moved, Jonathan, his girlfriend, and their daughter all lived with Mona. When the couple had another daughter, the four-bedroom house became full. Still, Aaron and Jonah claimed to live there as well, as Aaron tried his best to appear stable for Jonah's mother. However, the fact that Aaron and Jonah were forced to share a bedroom in the overly occupied home didn't fare well with Jonah's mother. None of the information I shared with Jonah's family, nor the information they found while investigating Aaron, made them comfortable, and after months of compiling proof against Aaron, they decided it was time to call Los Angeles' Child Protection Agency to see about the living conditions to which Aaron was subjecting Jonah. I wasn't aware they'd done so until after the fact, when Jonah's grandmother in Chicago told me. Although the move was something I understood, and a necessary one on their part, I knew all too well there would be consequences for going against Aaron. Late one afternoon in April, 2 days after Jonah's family called Child Protective Services, there was a thunderous knock on my door. Looking out the peephole, I saw 3 police officers positioned to pounce, their hands on their weapons. Behind them was a thin Hispanic man holding a clipboard. My first thought was that there was an emergency in the building. I thought that maybe there was a murderer or rapist on the loose and the authorities were here with a property manager to secure the premises. That had to be it. They couldn't be there for me. Except they were. "Are you Corinne Steffens?" the man with the clipboard asked once I opened the door, my heart pounding nervously in my chest. The 3 police officers stood at the ready, their hands still on the butt of their pistols, as the man made his way through the wall of officers and to my front door. "Yes, what's going on?" I responded, growing more nervous and afraid by the second. "My name is Roberto Fernandez, and I am an agent with the Department of Children and Family Services for the County of Los Angeles. I am here, accompanied by officers of the Los Angeles Police Department, because DCFS has received an anonymous tip. May we come in?" "Sure," I said as I moved to the side, allowing the 4 of them to enter the apartment. I tried my best to remain calm as my anxiety began to turn to anger. I knew exactly who had done this. "Who else is in the home?" asked one of the officers. Just my son, I promptly replied, pointing to his closed bedroom door. Do you mind if we take a look around? No, go ahead. As the officers took the very brief tour of my tiny apartment, Agent Fernandez began to explain the details of the anonymous tip he received. The caller claimed you were running a brothel out of your home, subjecting your son to the presence of men coming in and out of the home. The caller alleged you were abusing heroin, as well as physically and emotionally abusing your son, leaving him alone for weeks at a time and not feeding him for days. I know who did this, I responded, shaking my head and smirking just a bit. Sir, I am on the tail end of a 5-year abusive relationship with my ex-husband. This man has also been abusive to his child, and the mother of that child just called your department to report him 2 days ago. I'm sure he thinks I either did it or had some part in it, and this is his way of getting back at me. As I continued to talk, the officers excused themselves and exited the apartment after assessing there was no immediate danger to the agent. So, you're saying all these allegations are false and were made as a form of retaliation from your ex-husband? Yes, sir. And there is an open case against him with the Department of Children and Family Services? Yep. It was just opened the other day. I can give you all the information and show you a paper trail documenting the abuse I have endured over the past 5 years, including battery and injury reports, all the temporary restraining orders I have had against him, and the attempts I have made to make those temporary orders permanent to no avail. Why haven't you been able to make them permanent? Because I can never find him. He doesn't live anywhere and moves around a lot. He's never had a steady job until now, and it's impossible to have him served at the CBS lot. No one can get past security. So I can never protect myself, and he keeps coming back. Are you sure he's the one making these allegations against you? Either him or his mother, yes. But he's the only one who knows where I live. I just moved into this apartment 2 months ago, and he's the only person who's been here. Plus, he's always tried to make me look like a bad mother. He's always lied about me on every level, privately and publicly. He's done nothing but try to destroy me and my son since the moment I let him into my life. I guess now he's trying to finish me off for good. I started crying, knowing I had opened myself up to Aaron's hateful antics once again, and I could be made to pay with my life and that of my innocent son. Over the course of my conversation with the agent, I gathered all the evidence I had of the abuse I suffered at Aaron's hand and gave him Aaron's full name, as well as Jonah's and that of Jonah's mother. I told him all about the years Aaron spent in court trying to keep Jonah away from his mother and how she'd finally had enough. I told the agent about the surveillance and the damaging things Jonah's family in Chicago had found out about Aaron. I even told him about Mona, and how she's accused me of abusing Jonah and even Naeem, that this was their go-to maneuver, their first line of attack when trying to ruin my life. I painted a complete picture of the situation for Agent Fernandez, and by the end of our first meeting, he knew I wasn't the problem. He knew I wasn't the bad one, and for the first time, I felt I had someone who believed in me and wanted to protect me from the monster I once married. It may have taken extreme circumstances, but I was glad to have someone in my corner. I was willing to go through whatever process the state needed if it meant they were going to help me protect myself against Aaron. He thought making these false reports against me would hurt me, but his plan was backfiring.
The first thing I need you to do is file a restraining order against your ex-husband again, and I will help you serve him, Agent Fernandez instructed. You have to do this as a measure of keeping you and your son safe and free from abuse. If the department feels you're not doing enough to keep your son safe from Aaron, that is considered abuse as well. So I'll help you do that.
He folded a sheet of paper in half and scribbled down a list of 3 recommendations. 1. Domestic violence group counseling and/or education to help mother recognize her behaviors which place her at risk of witnessing abuse. 2. Individual therapy to address ongoing anxiety. 3. Conjoint therapy for mother and son.
Though Agent Fernandez believed my stories of emotional and physical abuse, there was nothing he could do to close the case Aaron opened against me. Once a case is opened in Los Angeles County, it cannot be closed until certain steps are taken and the state finds the case satisfactorily addressed. Immediately, I filed a restraining order against Aaron, the third in 5 years, but this time, I had help getting it served. Agent Fernandez and the Los Angeles Police Department used social media to find out where Aaron would be and sat outside a local venue where he and his brother were scheduled to perform. I stayed by the phone that night as Agent Fernandez called me frequently with updates from his car outside the venue. Finally, as I dozed off on the sofa, I received one final call. "He's been served," Agent Fernandez reported. "Oh my God, thank you, thank you, thank you," I exclaimed, delighted to know I'd finally been able to take the step needed to protect myself against Aaron. Aaron's restraining order against me, which he'd filed back in 2008, was still valid, but neither of us had been adhering to it. Even when I asked Aaron to stay away, he wouldn't, even though he was the one who filed the order. I was tired of this sick cycle, and after he made such disgusting claims against me with the Department of Children and Family Services, I was ready to protect myself. This was the ultimate first step. Over the next several weeks, Agent Fernandez scheduled various appointments for my son and me. Naeem and I entered counseling, alone and together, and Naeem underwent a series of medical and dental exams. I was evaluated by a team of psychiatrists and underwent the drug testing necessitated by the claims made against me. Naturally, all of our physical, mental, and emotional evaluations came back without any hiccups, and my drug evaluation showed I had not consumed any drugs of any kind. Aaron's attempt to, once again, make me seem like a bad mother and person had failed. In many ways, I felt vindicated to be able to prove, for once, that everything he'd been saying about me was false. And after seeing how abusive Aaron had been to my son and me, including his most recent false claims, the Department of Children and Family Services took an even closer look at the case Jonah's mother had filed against him. Aaron was in jeopardy of losing custody of Jonah, and my restraining order against him had the potential to be the nail in the proverbial coffin. Even though I hadn't fought his petition for a restraining order against me years before, Aaron was hell-bent against letting me protect myself against him in a court of law. He enlisted one of his mother's best friends, an attorney he used to do most of his dirty work. What I hadn't foreseen when filing the restraining order at the request of Agent Fernandez was the legal fight Aaron would demand and the thousands of dollars it would cost me, money I didn't have. Even in my attempts to finally be free from Aaron, I stood to lose what little I had left. Whether I wanted to go to court or not, I had to. The Department of Children and Family Services demanded I seek protection against Aaron with no concern as to the mental stress, anguish, anxiety, and financial burden it would cost. So on May 5th, 2011, I engaged an attorney and prepared to fight for my life. While the DCFS case against me dwindled, I appeared in a Los Angeles County court every 2 weeks as Aaron made sure my attempt to protect my son and myself against him dragged on. On every hearing date, I made my way to the courthouse over an hour away from my apartment, sometimes accompanied by my attorney, sometimes not. I never even saw the inside of the courtroom as the attorneys met with the judge in his chambers, admitting evidence, only to have the case continued. And Aaron always came to the courthouse with a group of intimidators, including his mother. There were always at least four of them against me as I sat alone outside the courtroom, my stomach swirling and my heart racing. There always seemed to be a reason for a continuance. Aaron always found a way to spin the truth in his favor and made me look like a psychopath, even though I was the one with the nearly endless paper trail of all he'd put me through. I was under an exorbitant amount of stress, and it was mostly evident in my massive weight loss. Nothing in my closet fit me anymore. Even my panties were too loose, and I had to pin them to make them fit.
I was sick and unable to bear the sight or smell of food. Every morning that I had to take the long drive to the courthouse, I vomited. The stress was just too much for me. All I wanted was to be free and to know that Aaron could be forced to stay away from me. All he wanted was to have full access to me and to keep Jonah's mother from having another piece of evidence that would help her regain custody of her son. We were in court the entire month of May and into June, and the fact that I had to fight so hard and long to be protected against a man who had been physically abusing me for the past 5 years, when that abuse had been documented in police and injury reports, baffled me. I wondered what this process must be like for women with no resources and no documentation. I wondered about those women who, like me, had no family to support them and no one to protect them from monsters like Aaron. It made sense to me all of a sudden how so many women wind up dead at the hands of their abusers and why so many abusers meet the same fate at the hands of their victims. Aaron, his family, friends, and his attorney painted me as the aggressor and he as the victim, and the court seemed incapable of seeing Aaron's lies for what they were. I was being blamed for being abused. As mid-June approached, the Department of Children and Family Services closed their case against me, and I was relieved to be finished with them. Around the same time, Aaron's case with DCFS was also closed, and Agent Fernandez exited my life. One weight had been lifted from me, but still a huge load remained. I was due back in court in about a week to continue my fight against Aaron, and I was dreading it. It was difficult to know whether to keep going or cut my losses at that point. I'd invested over $10,000 and countless hours building my case with my attorney. The biggest part of me wanted to give up, but I was overpowered by my need to win the order of protection. As horrible as I felt, as sick as the process was making me, I didn't know how to walk away. I didn't know if I should. As much as I wanted to quit, I was looking to be justified. I wanted to be protected. So I geared up for another week of stress and anxiety as I prepared my documents for court. Chapter 17. Same Tune. There weren't many people in whom I could confide as I went through this latest ordeal with Aaron. I could always talk to Deneen, and she did her very best to support me from far away, but there was only so much she could do from Alabama. I spoke to her most every day, and on the days I was due in court, she stayed on the phone with me from the time I woke up until I arrived at the courthouse, then while I drove home. But in between those phone calls, I felt alone. I was ashamed to tell anyone else that I'd let things with Aaron get this far. Everyone I knew had either warned me about him before or just after we began dating. Many of my friends gave up on me and on helping me to get away from Aaron after I continued to go back to him and defend him for so many years. I couldn't explain to any of them that I had let him back into my life after the move and all that decision had cost me. Still, in the midst of all the chaos, I struggled to keep some sort of social life, to see friends when they were in town, and to laugh every once in a while, no matter how fake that laugh had to be. I stayed in contact with Shad's assistant, Ant, over the years, after being introduced to him while visiting Shad back in 2008. Shad and I tried to keep in touch after I got back with Aaron in 2009, but life took us in different directions, and our conversations became few and far between. We managed to reunite in the summer of 2010, but we're not as close as we used to be. Still, we kept in touch and saw one another most times he visited Los Angeles. Mainly, those visits were solemn as I found it hard to engage, feeling far removed from the life I used to have and the woman I used to be. Shad often commented on my extreme weight loss and change in mood, and all I could say was that I was going through something. I was too embarrassed to admit he was right when he told me how stupid I was to get back with Aaron back in 2009. I was keeping all this pain, guilt, and shame buried deep inside, and felt I was losing my mind more with every intimidating trip to the courthouse. I was about to break when, one day, that June, I received a text from Aunt that would change my life and turn everything around. Aunt and I had been text messaging that night when he mentioned he was with Wayne and a few other friends we had in common. My heart swooned and my eyes watered as I realized just how awful my life had been since I walked away from Wayne nearly 3 years before. "I miss him so much," I texted back. "That man is the love of my life, and I should have never let him go." "I'm here with him," he wrote, "and I showed him your text message." He smiled real big, set to call him. Aunt gave me Wayne's phone number, and I frantically dialed. It rang. I held my breath. It rang some more. I shivered. The call went to voicemail. With my hands shaking, I proceeded to text him, "Hey, babe, it's Corinne." "Babe," he replied. "Hi, I miss you," I typed as I began to cry. "I need to see you when I come to LA." "Of course, just let me know when." "Baby, I love you and I miss you so much." "I love you too. Miss you. See you soon." Days later, I got the call. I got out of bed and did my best to pull myself together, self-conscious of my thinning hair and gaunt body. I put on my makeup and pulled together an outfit, ran to my car and sped out of the garage and into the darkness. I was nervous. I felt like I was going to be sick. My whole world was about to change, and seeing him again was nearly too much to bear. I pulled up to the studio and texted him, "I'm here." "Someone's coming," he replied. Seconds later, a burly security guard came out to greet me, confirm my identity, and open the gate. I drove into the parking lot, parked, took a deep breath, and headed in to find my love. I walked into the recording studio shortly after 3 a.m. and saw him for the first time in almost 3 years. He sat at his soundboard, his back to me, listening to songs he'd created for his upcoming album, The Carter Four. He bobbed his head and tapped his feet. His dreadlocks hung much longer than they had nearly 3 years before, and were now touching the middle of his back. They were tied with a rubber band and adorned with a fitted baseball cap. I was almost afraid for him to turn around. I lost my nerve and my breath. I'd been through so much since I'd seen him last. I'd been ruined. I'd lost everything and forgotten who I was. I had been used and abused and left for dead. I put up with shit from someone I would have never stayed with if I would have just stayed with Wayne through all his bullshit, all the disappointment that came with him. The devil I knew was better than the devil I didn't. Fuck. What if I wasn't good enough for him anymore? What if he took one look at me and saw how broken I was and wanted nothing to do with the shell I'd become? It took everything I had not to cry right then and there. I felt weak. My heart raced. All I wanted to do was fall into his arms and weep. Then Wayne looked forward and saw my reflection in the glass that separated the studio from the recording booth. He turned around in his swivel chair, rose to his feet, and opened his arms. It all seemed to happen in slow motion, like a dream sequence. In fact, I guess it was. It was the dream I'd been dreaming for the past 3 years. Now here it was. Here he was, and my nightmares were over. He had no idea the journey I had without him. He had no idea how bad it had all gotten, how much I'd lost, and how much had been taken from me. I fell into him and held him tightly, like it was the end of the world. And I was saved. There was so much I wanted to say, so much I needed to tell him. I wanted to cry, bawl. I wanted to fall to the floor and kiss his fucking feet. I was overwhelmed. But I kept it all together, looking at the handful of people in the room, afraid to be vulnerable in front of them. "Hey, babe,"
How you been? He asked as he embraced me. Ugh. I wanted to just blurt it all out. I wanted to tell him I'd been doing horribly, that I married a monster and ruined my life, that I was devastated by the secret he kept from me all those years ago and shattered by my decision to leave. But all that came out was, "I'm good, babe." As I squeezed his muscular frame and inhaled his scent, burying my nose in his neck among his dreads. Trying my hardest to keep cool, I peeled myself away from him and took a seat on a nearby sofa. He sat back in the swivel chair and spun it around to face me. "You look good, babe," he assured, even though I didn't. "Not really. Not to me. I just wasn't at my best with all the weight loss and my thinning hair slicked back in a ponytail, my nails undone, and my face tired. But it was dark in the studio, and he hadn't seen me in years. "Thanks, you too. I'm so happy to see you. I'm happy to see you too, babe, for real." I was greeted warmly and hugged by members of Wayne's crew, and I felt at home. More at home than I'd felt in a long time. The loud music, the weed smoke, the laughter. I was surrounded by people I knew, and I was safe. Comfortable. Wayne was more jovial than I remembered him. He was lively and cracking jokes. He held court in the studio, telling stories and revealing the secret menu items at fast food restaurants like the McGangbang at McDonald's. We all laughed, holding our stomachs at times and keeling over. He was beautiful. He was perfect. Wayne doted on me, as he always had in the past, making sure I had everything I needed while at the studio with him. We talked a bit. He asked about my son, and I asked about his four children. He'd fathered two more by two more women since I last saw him. We talked about the old days, things we'd done, places we'd been, and he reminded me of who I was. I'd become so accustomed to being broken down and devoid of spirit that it was hard for me to remember the old me, the lively me who awoke with a smile every morning. I was happy when I was with Wayne, and miserable without him. With joy in my heart and a smile of contentment upon my face, I looked around that dark, smoky studio and realized something. I wasn't normal, nor was anyone there that night, and nothing about my life had ever been ordinary, common, average, or regular. I'd been chasing something that was never meant for me. And on that night, I decided I wouldn't chase it anymore. It was the idea that I had to be normal, the notion that being different was wrong, that had driven me into a horrible marriage, a painful divorce, and now a disturbing, drawn-out court case. But as I looked around the studio and the people in it, I realized that I had access to something so many normal people wish they had. These non-normal, extraordinary moments of pure insanity and laughter inside a dark room with people who didn't judge, who didn't care, who were just there for the love of it. I wasn't normal, and I could never have normal, and that had to be okay with me. It was nearly 7 a.m. when we all oozed out of the recording studio. I was exhausted but full of life and looking forward to spending some quiet time alone with Wayne. He hopped into a chauffeured Cadillac SUV, and I followed behind him in my Mercedes. The streets were empty, and the sun shone a yellowish orange. It was a beautiful morning. As I followed behind Wayne's car to the Montage Hotel in Beverly Hills, I practiced what I would say when we were finally alone for the first time in so long. "Wayne, that day on the bus, I was upset because..." No, I didn't think that was a good starting point. "Babe, I love you so much, and I'm so sorry for..." Fuck, that was too sappy. He'd never respond to that. "Take me with you. Wherever you're going, just fucking take me with you." Yeah, no. Upon our arrival, we entered through the back side of the building. We walked through the bowels of the hotel and into the service elevator, which took us to the top floor. Without saying much, I hopped into the shower as he ordered a cup of coffee and popped in a CD of his new music from the Carter Four. I wrapped myself in a robe and settled onto the sofa beside him. "My back hurts, babe,"
he announced softly while reaching for a spot between his shoulder blades. I rushed to soothe him. I rose from my seat and walked into the bathroom to fetch a bottle of lotion. Returning, I slid between him and the sofa and proceeded to rub his back and shoulders. I ran my fingers over his tattoos, tracing them, following them like a trail back home. I found my way back to his gunshot scar, as I always had. I lowered my lips, kissed it, and said a silent prayer, thanking God for saving his life and bringing him back to me. I wanted to tell him everything. I wanted to tell him how sorry I was for walking away from him and all the shit I'd gone through because of it. I wanted to tell him why I left. I wanted him to know how I cried when he went to prison and when he was released. I wanted to say so much, but I couldn't. I couldn't burden him or us with the past. Wayne and I had been given a second chance, and I was determined to never let him go and not push him away again. So instead, I pulled his body into mine. I took him into me. I made love to him all morning long. Chapter 18. It was all so ridiculous. 2 days after being reunited with Wayne, I was scheduled to be in court with Aaron to continue fighting for a restraining order against him. This was our fourth or fifth appearance in court, and every time we went, he would show up with his attorney, his mother, other family members and friends, or even his mother's next-door neighbor, for Christ's sake. As for me, over the past months, I'd show up all alone, gaunt and feeble, clutching my papers, sitting in a corner by myself, looking at the floor and waiting to be called. They had been like a pack of wolves, and I was all alone with no support, just trying to get this man out of my life for good. After being with Wayne, however, I no longer felt alone or outnumbered. I was empowered by him and infected with his swagger. Before, I'd vomit every morning before going to court, my stomach nervous and unsettled. But on this morning, I awoke and felt nothing. I couldn't have given less of a shit about Aaron and his band of intimidators. They were all a bunch of nobodies and has-beens, and Wayne had reminded me that I was a star, a light, and I deserved to shine again. I was ready to take back what my relationship with Aaron had taken from me. I was back with Wayne and divorced from Aaron. I was in the perfect position to start over, and going back and forth to court, holding on and contributing to the negative energy that had held me captive for so long, was only doing me a disservice. I could see that now. So I walked into the courthouse that morning with just one agenda: dropping my case. For the first time in years, I could eat again. After being with Wayne, I was suddenly hungry. I was happy, beaming. I had confidence and now knew who I was and what I was worth. I dropped my request for the restraining order, and Aaron dropped his request to renew the original restraining order he imposed before we were married. I walked out of that courtroom, head held high, with a big, bright smile on my face, my ex-husband trailing behind me. "Maybe we can go to a movie or something this weekend," he suggested. "Sure," I replied. I kissed and hugged his mother and everyone else he had with him that day. "I love you, Corinne," Mona insisted. "I wish you guys didn't have to put each other through all this. You should bring Naeem by the house to play with the other grandkids sometime next week." "Sure," I replied, before waving goodbye to my past, taking the long walk back to my car, and driving into my future. I was smiling so hard my face hurt. I was just so happy. I drove away from that courthouse determined to never see it again, and I didn't call Aaron or visit my ex-mother-in-law. I just fucking left. I never told Wayne what he did for me or about my battles with my ex-husband. He never knew about my inability to eat or the physical changes I'd gone through from the stress and pressure of being in such a tormenting relationship. The vomiting, the nerves, my thinning hair and yellowing nails, the weight loss, the loss of all my confidence and self-worth. He never knew about it. He never heard about the beatings, the choking. Not since he hung up on me the first night of my birthday when I tried to confide in him about the first time Aaron abused me. His pride would never have allowed him to allow me to tell him about any other man in my life. I learned on that night back in 2007 that Wayne didn't want to know everything, or anything at all, except that I loved him. But I often wanted to tell him how his power empowered me and gave me everything I needed to leave the worst relationship of my life. How by just being in my life again, he'd given me something no one else could. I'd left a piece of myself with him on that bus back in 2008. And unbeknownst to him, he carried it with him during our years apart. Now I had it back. He'd given me back a piece of myself and completed me. Still, after all of that, after finally getting back to the place I belonged and to the man I loved, and after making my escape from a horrific life with Aaron and I were not over. With no restraining orders with which to contend, Aaron began coming back around and courting me. He'd oftentimes show up with a bouquet of my favorite flowers, red roses and star lilies, and a box of chocolates or something else delectably sweet. He was pouring it on thick and talking about getting back together, remarried even, but I wasn't interested. Not in a romantic relationship with him, and certainly not in remarrying him. I was invigorated, falling back into the skin of the person I used to be. I was stronger and more resilient. I was beautiful again, and feeling better than I had since I left Wayne that day on the tour bus. I had pep in my step, a sway in my hair, and a gleam of light in my eye. I was coming alive again, and even though there was nothing to stop Aaron from popping up at my doorstep, there was a wall keeping him from lunging back into my heart and mind. I was back with Wayne, and nothing and no one could bring me down. Long gone was the sorry sap looking for normalcy or to be secured by a man, family, and the look of perfection. For the first time in 4 years, I wouldn't be going back to Aaron. However, I felt bad for our children, these two innocent boys, brothers, who were being torn apart by abuse and divorce. Mostly, I felt sorry for Jonah. I felt bad that he didn't have sameness and a place to call home. There was very little stability in his life, and he never knew where he would be from one day to the next or who would be picking him up from school. Even though everyone surrounding him were family and friends, children thrive on stability and repetition, and it seemed extremely rare for him to ever have the same day twice. As it happened, my new apartment was just one block away from CBS Studios, where Aaron filmed the soap opera, and about 8 minutes from the school Jonah attended. So, with Aaron not having a stable home, it was convenient for him to come by my place with Jonah during the week. His alternative was to drive out to his mother's house over an hour away, 2 hours in traffic. As always, I was convenient for Aaron. But between my guilt about the children and Aaron's rambling ways, I didn't mind allowing him and Jonah to spend time or sleep at my place. It was nice to have the kids back together again. I enjoyed being able to get Jonah ready for school, ironing his uniform and preparing his lunches. It felt good to be a mom to him again. Naeem, however, seemed to be annoyed with the whole situation. He hadn't fallen into the old routines he once had with Jonah. He was a bit older and a lot wiser, and still harbored hurt over the pain Aaron caused him and me over the years, and I couldn't blame him. Though Naeem was cordial, he was never really into it, and was simply tolerating having Aaron and Jonah back in our lives. As for me, I felt safe. Aaron was no longer a threat to me. Having Wayne back in my life was a serious boost, and I was dating other people as well. I was going out again, accepting invitations to parties and taking trips with friends. Then, I remarried. In August 2011, I met a man who lived in my apartment complex. I'd seen him around often. He was an ugly man, dark-skinned and very short. His hair was dreadlocked and his island accent was very heavy. I could tell he was Jamaican, and figured he was somehow related to Rohan Marley, son of Bob Marley. Rohan lived upstairs, and he and I had a brief series of intimate encounters soon after I moved into the building 8 months prior. Nothing more ever came of it, but Rohan and I remained cordial neighbors. After seeing him numerous times around the property and in the parking garage, often driving Rohan's cars, the mysterious Jamaican finally spoke and we were introduced. His name was Nigel, and he was Rohan's cousin, temporarily in the United States on a work visa. There was something endearing and indigenous about Nigel. He reminded me of home. Born and raised in the Virgin Islands, I was very accustomed to his way of speech and his way of life, his cooking, and I related to the memories he had of growing up in Jamaica. We connected on these points, and I thought he was exactly what I needed in my life at the time. I needed someone to keep Aaron away, first and foremost. He was a watchdog of sorts. Plus, Nigel would provide balance. I could have late studio nights and days of intimate private time with Wayne, and then this regular island life at home when I wasn't with the love of my life. Essentially, I created a scenario in my head, the perfect arrangement and its benefits to me. Nigel would be my houseboy, the kind of man I thought Aaron was when he and I first started dating back in 2007. I could have Nigel at the apartment to keep the home fires burning while I ran around town, living my life, regaining my independence, confidence, and inspiration to get back to work. While I am obviously a woman and possess many traditional feminine qualities, much of my personality and many of my traits can be described as traditionally masculine. There were times during my relationship and marriage to Aaron when I was content to be the housewife, cooking and cleaning for my family. But unlike most housewives, I was doing all of that and making all the money and paying all the bills. Initially with Aaron, what I wanted and thought I was getting was a man who would support my endeavors at home while I strengthened my career and built my fortune. I didn't mind paying all the bills as long as my ability to work and live the life I wanted was not obstructed. I didn't want a rival, and I certainly didn't want an oppressor. Well, that plan blew up in my face. This time, I would choose a man who had nothing to lose and everything to gain by supporting me. I imagined he'd cook and clean and make sure the car was washed. He would take care of the tedious responsibilities of home life while I worked on my appearance, my social life, and regaining my footing in publishing. It had been 2 years since my publisher dropped me, and I desperately needed a way back into the industry. In return for all his hard work and dedication to my success, he'd be well taken care of and married to me, and eventually, if all went well, he could get his American citizenship. Plus, he would help me project a picture of normalcy to the public while I ran around being as unnormal as fucking possible. Though I no longer wanted the same things I sought in past relationships, I knew the public needed to see me being more like them, if only for a moment. Nigel would provide the perfect public smokescreen while I focused on my relationship with Wayne privately. I told Nigel the whole thing wouldn't last more than 2 years, though he always laughed when I said it. I told him I had a plan, but never divulged its details. Nigel had no idea what he was getting himself into, but he was in a desperate situation. Rohan made it possible for him to obtain the work visa by claiming to hire Nigel, and though Nigel did work for him as a gopher, he wasn't paid well. I was offering Nigel everything he needed as long as he gave me everything I needed. The plan was perfect, and he went along with it, easily, not knowing all the details. 5 weeks after meeting Nigel, in September 2011, he and I were married. The ceremony was held in the same chapel where Aaron and I were wed, and the managers of the establishment gave me a 10% discount for being a repeat customer. Seriously. This time, I bought a dress, a cocktail-length lace number by Betsy Johnson. I also bought outfits for Nigel and Naeem and enlisted one bridesmaid, who bought me the perfect bouquet of roses and star lilies. I knew this was more of a business arrangement than it was a marriage, but I wanted to have a little fun with the wedding and make it somewhat different from the one I had with Aaron. One thing was for sure, I wouldn't be getting choked and spit on once I got home. During the ceremony, when the officiant read the section of the vows that spoke of faithfulness, I stalled while repeating them. I smirked. I wanted to bust out in a fit of laughter because Nigel and I both knew this marriage was never going to be about faithfulness. Nigel lowered his chin, stared up at me, and sputtered the words, "I promise to be faithful." The truth was, even if I was in love with this man and had every intention of having a traditional, monogamous marriage with him, there was no way I would have been able to. In addition to his physical unattractiveness, Nigel was not a very smart man. Though he had more than his share of vocational knowledge, he lacked book smarts, and I found myself having to correct him often as he used words that simply did not exist. All in all, Nigel was not a catch, and certainly no one to whom I'd consider being faithful. So I repeated the faithfulness vow and all the other erroneous vows with a roll of my eyes and a smirk on my face. It was all so ridiculous. After the ceremony, I skipped out of the chapel, bouquet in hand, happy to have completed the first steps of my plan to regain my life. I was married to a man I didn't love, but who wouldn't beat me? All he had to do was take care of me, and in a couple years, he could have his citizenship. We passed by a barbershop just two doors down from the chapel, Nigel trailing behind me, followed by Naeem and my lone bridesmaid. Outside the shop, there were three barbers sitting there on a break. One of the barbers wore long, neat dreadlocks and seemed to be of island descent. He extended his hand to Nigel. "You guys just got married?" the stranger asked. "Yeah, man," Nigel replied happily. "Congratulations." "Thank you, thank you." The two men shared a congratulatory fist bump. It was all so ridiculous. Nigel came into the arrangement knowing I had a plan and knowing all about my relationship with Wayne. During those first 5 weeks before we were wed, I saw Wayne quite often and never felt the need to hide the relationship from Nigel or anyone else. I was back where I belonged, and anyone